name is Tim Fresca. I'm from the Latino Commission on AIDS. I'd like to thank the organizers for this invitation to talk about our Deep South project, which is about stimulating strategic thinking with partners in that region on how to improve prevention and care services for Latino populations. This project is supported by the Ford Foundation and by the commission that employs. I just want to make one mention about the commission itself. We're based in New York, which may sound a little odd for doing a project in the Deep South. The commission in its origins was very much oriented to the five boroughs, but as the Latino population of the United States has evolved, the commission has also had much more of a national focus, and this is one reflection of that. How do I make the advance? Oh, thank you. These are the seven states involved. You might notice that it does not include Florida and Texas, which is where Hispanic populations have been around for much longer time. It could have easily included Virginia, Arkansas, perhaps Kentucky, but we had to draw the line somewhere. I just want to make one comment about demographics. This is a map showing the concentration of the Latino population in the last census, and you would expect it, the heavier, the darker areas to be in the Southwest, California, Texas, and Miami. But if you look at the percentage change over the last two censuses, you can see that the epicenter has shifted to North Carolina. There's a good deal of a very rapid increase in the upper Midwest, all throughout the South, the Tennessee Valley, Denver, and Las Vegas. So that is a reflection of the shifting demographics of our country. Here's another look at the same thing. The top 10 states in terms of percentage change, seven of them are in the South, and if this data had been collected post-Katrina, it would be eight, because Louisiana would be included as well. Here's the raw numbers. It's a total of 2 million people in the seven states of our project. Just to keep that in perspective, California has 12 million Latinos alone. However, these are new arrivals for the most part, and there are some important differences as listed in that slide. I won't go through it all, but there is one study, just by way of example, a project, it's a testing project actually in rural Georgia. Over 1,000 men were tested, of Hispanic immigrant workers in chicken plants, I believe. Less than 1% had a high school diploma. Here's a picture that I think really reflects the new South. This is on the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain in Louisiana. You can see a couple of good old boys going in to get their fishing tackle. You can pick up your crawfish po' boy, your live crabs, and if you look over on the extreme left, you can see a sign for tamales. And you can also get a job here. The sign is large enough to attract the attention of any passerby. And it has a lot to do with the fact that there is such a demand for cheap labor in these areas that's why the immigrants have poured in there. Now, if we look at the epidemiology of HIV among Latinos, it's not so easy to get comparable data across the different states because they all use different, they have all idiosyncrasies about how they gather their data and how they report it. However, the other thing is that it's very hard to have a denominator in order to calculate an incidence or a prevalence rate because nobody knows how many people are there. There's a lot of transients, so you don't really know whether people are in this state or that state. However, one thing you can calculate is, of the new cases, how many of those, what proportion of those cases are Latinos. And that's pretty easy to calculate, and that's why I chose this slide from using North Carolina data. And this is among the newer Latino populations. This is slightly older, so you can see a definite trend upward. And I would just like to point out that the 9% figure in the last data of this year is already above the proportion of Latinos in the state of North Carolina. And if you take only men, it's 11%. So our project goals were to find out, to meet, and to encourage. We wanted to do some basic data gathering, fact-finding, meet the local partners, and encourage them to think strategically about how to improve care and prevention services. And them, in this case, is really in two categories. the traditional AIDS service organizations, the providers that are already there, and also new actors that might not have thought about this particular issue, especially people dealing with Latino populations but have not thought about adding the HIV piece. We used a variety of techniques. I think the important piece is, aside from actually going to these places and spending a good deal of time seeing people on site, we tried to cast a wide net and really look at as many different people, anyone who had connections to that community, and bring them into this process if possible, including Spanish language media, which I'll mention in a couple of minutes. This is just a rundown of our total interviews. You can see that the left-hand column shows the different categories. AIDS service organizations were in the first place, of course, but and then government, but there's a lot of other categories there as well, people with HIV, primary care providers, Latino organizations, religious groups, journalists, and academics. So just briefly looking at the conditions that we found, the prevention scenario is a little grim, I would say. There's a lot of heroic efforts going on, but they're rather scattershot, and it's really problematic, I would say, for everybody working in this area, trying to talk to people about a disease that they might get 10 years from now when they have all these diseases now that they can't deal with because of lack of access and a whole host of other problems that have to do with their immigrant condition. And just in passing, I'm certainly not an expert on this from a theoretical basis, but I think that we need to look at immigration as not just an aggravating factor, but as a primary cause, because it just comes back over and over again, people saying, this is the package of my life or our clients' lives, and this is what makes it impossible or very difficult for us to reduce risk. On the other hand, the HIV care scenarios, you actually get HIV, oddly enough, and this was a surprise for me, you often can get care, at least clinical care, and I would attribute that to heroic efforts on the part of providers, but also because the numbers are still relatively low. So you can say, you will find providers who say, yes, people come in here, they don't have documents, we can still handle that, we can still get the medicines, and so forth. But if you go to the next step and say, well, how many cases like that do you have? Well, 6 out of a caseload of 400. Okay, but then if it becomes 60, it's a different story, and it's not 60 yet, but that's why we're trying to intervene at this stage. The other thing is we have a healthy population, as represented by our typical fellows whom we met in North Carolina, single men, unaccompanied, living together, very transient, moving from place to place, following jobs, no English skills, and a very limited social network among Hispanics. They are unaccompanied despite the presence of our intern there, who is not accompanying them despite the fact that one of them was quite interested in seeing if that could happen. The statistics bear out the gender imbalance. This is not surprising, I suppose, to anyone here. On the right-hand side, you can see the male-female ratios there. That includes children, so if you take away children and look at simply adults, it would be much more pronounced. Of course, there are plenty of women around as well, and they face the same kinds of vulnerabilities as you'd expect: social isolation, economic dependence, and especially the lack of transport. If they're dealing with child-rearing, it's very hard, very typical for them to be isolated and far away. The vulnerabilities, we looked at the research, and this list here would not surprise anyone. There's nothing particularly startling there, except of the issue of therapeutic injections, over-the-counter antibiotics that you can get in Mexico and inject yourself. I read about that. I didn't hear about it, so I don't know how widespread that is. There is an issue of misinformation, marginality, and so forth, and I'd like to just emphasize again that all these items reinforce each other. It's not just one thing. What I did find, there was also a few surprises, things that you've seen in the HIV world for many years. I would just point to the whole issue of fear and distrust, and particularly fear of violence. People who are not willing to use any official institutions or to recur to them feel very exposed to whatever may happen to them without recourse. Here's an example in terms of distance from the health system. This is about a visit to an emergency room. Very few of us go to the hospital because we don't get sick, just from the idea of the death. I went to the hospital once in Connecticut for a stomach problem, and my surprise came when the bill arrived, $1,000. Just for the doctor who came and touched my stomach with two fingers was $250. That was a new experience for me. And you know what? I haven't been sick since. Then from the agency side, there's a disconnect as well. This is an agency, not an AIDS agency, in one state, who said to me, "We held our first event for the Latino community and had food, everything translated into Spanish, really a nice affair prepared. And no one came, not one person. We did it again and still no response. Then someone said, 'You probably shouldn't hold it at the police precinct house.' We hadn't thought of that." The typical agency responses are, you can see in this list, very common is outreach, different kinds of outreach, and of course care if they can provide it. This is a typical approach, a condom mobile, and it's quite effective in normalizing the issue and destigmatizing. However, it's very highly dependent on the personality of the person who's leading that project. In this case, it's a great guy. But if he decides to take another job, then the whole project tends to shrink. This is a version of the same thing in New Orleans near Charity Hospital, which no longer exists. The problem in this case is that if you look there, it says AIDS on the side. So anyone going to use that facility, privacy goes out the window. Health fairs are also big. This was a group in Durham that leafleted this neighborhood before the health fair, noticed the police officer participating, and the chief of police actually attended because the Durham police have fought the idea that they would be immigration agents unsuccessfully so far. We also do NLAD, which is a National Latino AIDS Awareness Day. That's a growing thing, and then we've had much more participation in the South this year. I also want to make reference, as winding down here, to the fact that these are not bereft and helpless communities. There are a lot of resources there if we know how to tap into them. Some of them are quite informal. Of course, churches are big. This is Pastor Gonzalez outside of New Orleans. He has now, 2 years after the storm, still 30 single men sleeping behind the altar in his church. And this is an automatic point of contact for Latino communities. Churches, any churches who have Hispanic outreach, that's where people go. ESL classes are big, so that's also an excellent point of contact. Hiring halls in places where communities have been wise enough to get the day laborers off the street into a facility or an institution, this is a perfect place for you to do any kind of education because they trust the people who are running the hiring hall. This is in South Carolina. Another phenomenon that's very common is that Latino immigrants tend to take over an apartment complex. They start moving in, everybody else moves out. So that becomes an intervention unit in itself. Even though the individual may be highly transient, the entity is permanent. And they often have public spaces that can be turned into meeting places. And in the case of Mexicans, there's always the Virgin of Guadalupe somewhere nearby. In this case, she's right there on the site, and when they have festivals, hundreds of people show up at this site. Trailer parks are also big, and some of all kinds and varieties. Sometimes quite basic, but other times they can be quite cozy, and they look permanent. The other thing is Spanish language media, which I want to make a mention of. If you see satellite dishes, it's usually because that's a Hispanic neighborhood, thank you. Because you can get a lot more Spanish channels on satellite than you can on cable. And there are many Spanish language newspapers throughout the region. I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to make too much mention of we're doing an analysis of all the papers that we could find. We took a month, and I'll just make one comment about the content, which is that children's health And women's health and maternal health are by far the health messages that we are finding in these papers, even though men far outnumber women in that community, in those communities. This is a community credit union. I'll have to skip over that. Thank you, I'm running out of time. I just wanted to make one mention that we have tried to seek these alliances broadly, come together with people, and oddly enough, Louisiana was the first state to jump on the idea that we should have a statewide strategy for Latino population dealing with HIV. We did that event about 2 weeks ago. We had a great turnout. People seemed quite happy about it. 66 participants. And we have organizing committees in two more states to repeat the process. So thank you very much.